take your seats, ladies and gentlemen?
Yes.
This is the right time to take a picture.
Okay, this is the last session that we're going to have, and we're going to do it on time. And we're going to actually have time for questions and answers at the end. It's a novel approach. We have three presenters, three discussants. Their names are in front of them. Their bios are in the book. I just have one update to a bio. Dr. Bechtel last night was elected by the board of directors of the International Council on Korean Studies as the president for the next 2 years. Hugo informs me that he's now running the council, so if you have any problems with X, get on Bechtel. So we're going to have 20 minutes each for the presentation, except Dr. Bechtel gets only 19 minutes. We're going to take a coffee break of about 10 minutes, and then we're going to have the discussants speak for 15 minutes each, and we'll have at least 15 minutes for questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Song Pyo Hong from Aju University, retired Air Force Colonel. Formerly, I worked at National Defense University of Korea. I taught defense policy, military strategy, air power strategy, and future warfare. This conference, I present my paper on North Korea's capability to conduct provocations and the rough U.S. capability to count them. That's my subject. So, it concludes.
Just go on.
Yeah. Where is my slides?
There it comes.
Let's do random rolling.
Dr. Bechtel is the president of IGS now, so.
My predecessor did this.
Let me just grab it 1 second, sir.
I just changed it. Oh, it is.
Let's get his effect called 16 instead of 19.
I'll talk fast.
Because I made some questions on this.
You'll have to use the
other.
Let me check this. I'll check this one. Just use this one.
Hey Bruce.
My presentation is composed of like this. After the introduction, the comparison of North and South Korea's conventional military strengths and North Korea's will for military provocation and the countering capability of the RAF-US combined forces and the conclusion. North Korea, as you know well, the Kim Jong-un's missile test and military demonstration reflects North Korea's instability after Kim Jong-un's sudden death. The economic hardship and the food shortage continued for decades. North Korea defectors in South Korea numbered approximately 23,000 at the end of 2011. That means North Korean political situation is unstable now. What about the surrounding countries' security or military situation focused on the advanced military equipment? China is exerting their utmost effort for developing J-20 and J-60, which is stealth fighters. And recently, they succeeded the Shenzhou-9 docking, and Russia is also concentrating their efforts for developing stealth fighter aircraft, PAC-4T-50. Japan also is under developing the stealth fighter Shimshin, and recently decided to exit F-35. The U.S. Announced a new defense strategy focused on Asia-Pacific region with a defense cut. That's the security environmental changes around the Korean Peninsula. How is the North Korea's military strength? North Korea has driven a military first policy for several decades. Since 1962, they actively drove four military policy lines, including fortification of all territories, armament of all people, modernization of military equipment, and officialization of all military personnel. And their basic military strategy toward the RAF is a short-term blitzkrieg strategy aiming to conclude the war before U.S. augmentation arrives at the Korean Peninsula. And the surprise attack and the combination of conventional and non-conventional warfare. North Korea's military provocations as follow: nuclear tests and missile tests, churn and ship sinking, artillery firing at Yeonpyeong Island, and verbal intimidation. That means escalated provocations in recent years. Comparison of the RAF and North Korea's military strengths is shown in the chart. As you know, the army personnel almost two-fold bigger. Air Force also, Air Force personnel is two-fold bigger than the South. And the Navy, South Korean Navy is bigger than the North. Of course, South Korean Navy includes the Marine Corps. So the military equipment for the aircraft comparison is shown in this chart. So North Korea and the RAF has quite a different number of equipment and personnel. But in numbers, North Korea is far superior than the South. But in quality, South Korea a bit stronger than North. For example, combat aircraft, North Korea has 35 MiG-29 and 34 Su-25, while Republic of Korea has 39 F-15 and 164 KF-16. The configuration and the performance data shows us the RAF's the fighter aircraft is stronger than North Korea. So in numbers, North Korea is strong, but in quality, South Korea is stronger than the North. For example, fourth generation fighters, MiG-29 versus F-15K or KF-16. Firepower, air-to-air radar performance is quite similar, but armament capability is RAF's F-15 or KF-16 is stronger than MiG-29. Then air-to-ground, all-weather, PGM performance is the strong. The RAF's aircraft is stronger than the North. Survivability is also, the RAF is stronger than the North. Maneuverability, combat maneuver performance is similar, but combat range and combat radius, the RAF is stronger than the North. Other performance, the RAF is advantageous than the North. Army equipment shows in this chart. Again, in numbers, North Korea is stronger than in the South, but in quality of the equipment, South Korea is stronger than the North. For example, tanks, North Korea, the most advanced equipment is M2000. The name is Pokpung-ho. Pokpung-ho, they have only 100 to 200 M2000, but the RAF K1 series, we have 1400. The performance data shows us the RAF's tank is superior than the North. And the second generation and first generation tanks, North Korea has a lot of tanks in number compared to the South. There is a comparison chart between M2000 and K1 and K1A1, as shown in this chart. Artillery gun, also, North Korea is strong in numbers, but in quality, South Korea is strong. For example, North Korea has 4,400 artillery guns, while South Korea has 1,000 approximately. In combat ship, North Korea has total 563 combat ships, while South Korea has 226. But as you can see on the chart, destroyers and frigates, corvettes, South Korea is far stronger than the North, but in total numbers, North Korea is stronger than the South. So North Korea's military capability, we had several clashes in Western Sea between South and North Korean Navy. It proves North Korea has mostly the conventional weapons systems, while the South Korea's Navy has advanced equipments and weapon systems. But North Korea try to overcome this weakness through their particularly proficient troops, asymmetric strategy, and WMD employment. For example, North Korean soldiers served for about 5 to 10 years, while South Korean conscript soldiers served for 2 years. So North Korean soldiers are well trained compared to the South. What about the North Korea's provocations? The chronicles shows us a very frequent military provocations by the North. Total number of provocations in 1950s, total 10, and the 60s, 78, 70s, 35, 80s, 18, and 2035. It's very strange because in 2000, we have a good relationship between South and North Korea, but military provocations quite a lot. So it is very difficult to precisely understand North Korea's intention all the time. Amongst them, the provocation by force like that. In 2000, five military provocations. There are chronicles of provocation by force. Especially in 1960s, there are the serious provocations. At the time, I was an elementary schoolboy. I was very much scared about North Korean infiltration during my schoolboy era. So especially 1960s, 1968 Blue House infiltration, and the Pueblo kidnapping incident, Ulchin Samchuk armed infiltrations, 1969 U.S. EC one-to-one shooting incidents happened. In 1976, Panmunjom X incident, and in 1983, Myanmar Yangon terror bombing, and the 87 Khan explosion incident. And in 1999, first Yeonpyeong battle, 2002, second Yeonpyeong battle, and 2009, Daechung battle. And, you know, the 2010, there was two most serious military provocation by the North. Chenan ship sinking and artillery firing at Yeonpyeong Island. This is the northern limit line, so it is very difficult to protect our national interest in NLL area because North Korea frequently invaded NLL based on their claim. They consisted the NLL looks like a southern line, but actually we have kept the NLL, the upper line. So very difficult to protect our national interest. These North Korea's military provocations indicates their very strong will to make a military provocation against the South. So North Korea's soldiers are very well trained by their long period of service. However, in overall quality of military capability, the ROK is superior to North Korea. In addition, the U.S. forces in Korea supports the ROK with its the warriors and military equipment, advanced military equipment, especially the strategic ISR, including U-2s and satellites. U.S. Air Force in Korea has 60 F-16 and 30 A-10s. The U.S. Army in Korea has 24 Apache helicopters and 70 UH-60 and many others.
We have about 3 minutes.
Okay then. How is the countering capability of ROK-US combined forces? We are well equipped by advanced network sentry warfare system, including advanced C4IR ISR systems. Accordingly, the ROK-US combined forces command can carry on precision engagements with PGMs against the North. And the ROK-US combined forces have strengthened operational capability through various combined trainings and exercises for more than 60 years, including Ulsi Freedom Guardian and Key Reserve Four Leaguers and many others. Thus, ROK-US combined forces can effectively conduct a defensive theater-level war without any further exercise. This made the ROK-US combined forces one of the strongest common defense systems in the world. In conclusion, North Korea recognized their weak position against the ROK-US combined forces in conventional asymmetric strategy. Therefore, North Korea will take asymmetric strategy with WMDs. The ROK-US combined forces have a reasonable sufficiency for countering North Korea's military provocation with its advanced weapon systems. So it can be said that countering capability of ROK-US combined forces is reasonably sufficient. However, as shown in military history, it is still very difficult to counter perfectly North Korea's asymmetric strategy with the WMDs. This is my presentation. Thank you very much.
You can just turn the whole thing off. I don't have any slides either. It's worse clean.
Okay.
Off would be good.
You should run it all off.
Off.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure. Well, Hugo Kim asked me to talk. Can everybody hear me? Hugo Kim asked me to talk about North Korea's capabilities that they've demonstrated since Kim Jong-un became the leader of North Korea. By the way, Jong-un is also the name of my wife. My wife's maiden name is Kang Jong-un, and which for those of you who are Korean, you know that means bright light or bright star of the river. Now our name means bright star of the Bechtel, which I think is very romantic. And her license plates say Jong-un. So last year, you know, we'd be driving around somewhere and we were in Koreatown in Houston, for example, you know, people be honking and she'd look at me. I don't know why people honking me. Why they honking? I don't know, honey. Anyway, so I'm here to talk about the capabilities that the North Koreans have shown us just since Kim Jong-il died in December. And for those of you who've read stuff that I've written in the past, you know that my focus on North Korea, it is my assessment that their most important non-nuclear threat is their asymmetric threat, which Dr. Hong talked about a bit earlier. That would be ballistic missiles, long-range artillery, and SOF. They demonstrated part of that in April when they test-fired their Taepodong-2, I'm sorry, the Unha-3 satellite. And I'll also talk a bit about a new capability North Korea has, which is a cyber capability, cyber and electronic warfare. And I'd also ask that you all not confuse the two. Cyber warfare is not the same as electronic warfare. And I'll talk about that later. But briefly, electronic warfare is military guys with sophisticated electronic warfare equipment probably outside jamming signals and stuff, and cyber warfare is guys with tape on their glasses, you know, jamming, you know, doing that kind of attack. So let's talk about the missile. The technology that the North Koreans have used us for in attempting to perfect a three-stage missile appears to be rather primitive when compared to other nation states who have already launched a similar platform. While there is some disagreement regarding the actual makeup of the missiles, many analysts agree that the first stage of a Taepodong 2 appears to be a cluster of Nodong engines. The second stage appears to be a Musudon, or parts of a Musudon, which is of course the North Korean version of the SSN-6. The third stage of the missile, the top, is unknown, although some analysts have said that it seems similar to the top stage of the Iranian Safir-2 platform, which was likely designed by the Iranians with a great deal of help from the North Koreans. The Taepodong-2 launched in 2012 was approximately 32 meters long, although many analysts have assessed it to be either slightly longer or slightly shorter. This is also something else that's interesting about this missile. It's the first time a launch was conducted from the site at Tongjang-ni. This site is an upgrade from the site at Musudon, which is on the east coast. As everyone knows, Tongjang-ni is on the west coast, and creates some challenges for intelligence collection and ballistic missile defense. Reportedly, the static rocket motor test stand at Tongjang-ni looks a lot like the one located in Iran, indicating probable collaboration on launch facilities between the Iranians and the North Koreans. The North Koreans had been building the site at Tongjang-ni at least 10 years before this launch, and may have, in fact, probably did aid the Iranians in building some of their sites as well. Missiles launched from the site at Tongjang-ni also can achieve a higher altitude before passing maritime ballistic missile defense platforms like the American Aegis-equipped ships, thus increasing survivability in any potential conflict. There are other advantages as well to the new site, such as an underground pipeline equipped with a fuel tank next to the launch pad that can hide fueling operations from potential satellite coverage. For those of you who follow this closely, like I do and like some other guys in the audience do, it's always, you know, we're always watching the signs as they're building up to these launches. One of those signs is, they've pulled trucks up, they've got the fueling going on. If they can hide some of the preparations, that helps cut down on our warning time. While the site is currently an upgrade from what currently exists at Musudon, warning time is not decreased. That's something that's very important because it still took the North Koreans several weeks to set up the launch. The southern, as opposed to eastern, trajectory is different and adds to the complications regarding North Korean options for launching missiles. They can now launch them east or south. And they've proven that, should the missile actually go past its first stage, I guess. The launch itself. Let's talk about the launch itself, if I may, for a few minutes. The platform exploded approximately 2 minutes after the launch, and the missile broke into about 20 pieces, all of which fell into the ocean about 165 kilometers southwest of Seoul. The cause of the failure may have been a fuel leakage or a flawed engine in the first stage rocket. Some analysts believe the North Koreans may have intentionally aborted the flight because of a problem with the staging system, which is certainly very likely. Other possibilities exist as well, though. The missile launch may have failed because the first stage propellant failed to separate from the rest of the system, and most analysts agree that the failure was possibly a result of a flaw in the first stage or the bottom of the missile. At any rate, this almost appears to be a step backward from the 2009 launch when the North Koreans were able to get the missile through its first two stages before it failed as it was transitioning into its third stage. So let's go back and review this. 1998, the North Koreans launched the Taepodong 1. As it's going from its first to its second stage, it blows up. In 2006, they launched the Taepodong 2 for the first time, slightly different than Taepodong 1, longer. It goes from its first stage, completes its first stage, as it's over the EC, it explodes, literally, as it's going into its second stage. 2009, they launch another Taepodong 2, goes all the way through its first stage, goes into its second stage successfully, goes all the way through its second stage, and as it's transitioning into its third stage, tumbles into the ocean. This is what makes it. Sorry about that. This is what makes a three-stage missile so complicated. You have to make sure the stages can actually, you know, complete. And I would also point out something else. North Korea, and I'll talk more about this, North Korea proliferates just about everything they make to the Iranians. The Iranians don't proliferate anything to the North Koreans. It's a cash and carry business. This is why the Iranians have launched a satellite, but they have not done it using a three-stage missile. The Safir-2 is a two-stage missile. The reason why? Because the North Koreans haven't figured out how to do it successfully yet. Connect the dots. Anyhow, unique aspects of the launch. The technology for a three-stage missile or a platform for a satellite are exactly the same, only the payload is different. So in other words, if you're looking at a Taepodong 2, you have a bulbous thing on top of this thing, it's a satellite launch. If you have something that's pointed, like a dummy warhead or a real warhead, it's a missile launch. It's the same platform. So for the North Koreans to say, we're launching a satellite, yeah, right, you're testing a missile. You know, who are we kidding? Thus, the threatening and provocative nature of the event and the negative international reaction. Another aspect of the launch was that it was, of course, the first to occur at the facility at Tongjongni. Though this does not give the North Koreans the ability to launch a covert launch, and I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. So the U.S. still has plenty of warning time when they launch a long-range missile. Other different aspects of this launch when compared to 98, 2006, and 2009 was the fact that, as all of you know, they invited the international press to attend way ahead of time. Everybody knows that, right? And for the first time ever, they publicly admitted that the launch was a failure. Although people like me would say, well, they didn't have much choice. The press was there. They saw it. You know, so how can you deny that? The political aspects of the context surrounding the launch are important as well. The launch showed that Kim Jong-il's policies, as planned before his death, were continued under his son. And the test launch is one of the very first examples that this would happen. According to former Acting Assistant Secretary of State Evans Revere, who many of us know, the North Koreans informed him during July of 2011 that, and I'm quoting, "We have the sovereign right to launch a satellite, and we will never give up the right no matter what." Now, this probably indicates that Pyongyang had begun plans to conduct a long-range missile test at least as early as mid-year 2011. There were other political aspects of this as well, dealing with the transition of power from father to son and policy being carried forward. As I said in a press piece that I wrote for the Korea Times on March 26th of 2012, and let me read this if I may, there may still be some confusion within the new government in North Korea with Kim Jong-un as its leader. Reportedly, during bilateral talks just days before Kim Jong-il's death, U.S. officials were notified of plans for a test launch, told the North Koreans that a ballistic missile launch, no matter what the purpose, would violate U.N. Security Council Resolution 1874 and breach agreements. And yet, the North Koreans went ahead with this deal and planned for new inspections and a moratorium on missile testing. They did this. And then, a few days later, they announced a satellite test launch, showing either obvious confusion in the process not proceeding as showing either obvious confusion or a decision reversal, and we still don't know which. So perhaps the North Korean succession process is not proceeding as smoothly as many have said it is in the press and other sources. It is a reasonable assessment to assume that while the launch would have occurred if Kim Jong-il were still alive, since it was a carryover of his policy, the diplomatic confusion that ensued under his son's regime would not have occurred under the elder Kim. So the first signs of the new government and the actions it takes and perhaps the confusion that's ensued. The last and perhaps most compelling aspect of the test launch conducted during April 2012 is related to proliferation. According to press sources, a 12-member Iranian delegation was sent to North Korea to observe the launch. The Iranians were engineers from the Shahid Hemat Industrial Group, or SHIG, and arrived in North Korea to watch all of the launch and pre-launch activities. The engineers reportedly were there to exchange information regarding the high-thrust engines and separation technology for the three-stage missile. In keeping with past exchanges between Iran and North Korea, Tehran is said to have helped to fund the launch in exchange for valuable data that can later be used for their own programs. SHIG is in charge of Iran's Shahab 3 program, which is really a no-dong, and they are in charge of other programs as well. A future successful launch of the Taepodang missile system will mean hundreds of millions of dollars or more in sales from North Korea to Iran. But even before that happens, the development technology sales between Pyongyang and Tehran continue to be mutually beneficial for both nations. And again, this is not what I would call collaboration. This is North Korea sells to Iran, Iran pays North Korea. Okay, the Shahab 3 is a Nodong. The Shahab 4 is a Musudan. These guys are not helping the North Koreans. The North Koreans are selling to them. So just keep that in mind, please. There is another missile capability that came to the forefront, and my good buddy Gordon Chang, who's standing in the back and looking quite handsome, I might add, he talked about it yesterday, and that is the new ICBM, if that's what it is, that was mounted on what is very obviously a Chinese transporter erector launcher. And the open reports I've seen in the press indicate that a Chinese firm sold this to the North Koreans, and apparently I've seen reports that there was 8 of them, and the Chinese government either looked the other way or didn't know about it. But one way or the other, the North Koreans have this missile. Now, in the press, and we've seen reports from Bill Gertz, who those of you who read the Washington Times know, he's a very well-known national security reporter. We've seen reports that he's written saying it's an ICBM, and that's what the Congress is calling it, and the President, and DOD. But when I looked at the picture of that missile, it looked an awful lot like a Musudan to me. You know what I mean? And the Musudan's an MRBM. So if they have this capability, if this actually is an ICBM and they can put it on a TEL, that has a significant impact on our ballistic missile defense. It is next to impossible to go after missiles that are on TELs. It's very hard. Ask anybody who fought in the Gulf War how hard that is. Even going after the Iraq, it is tough. So that would have a significant impact on our ballistic missile defense, if true. Anyway, so that's that. Also, the other thing, and Gordon mentioned this yesterday, the North Koreans have never, ever, ever, this is a fact, this is not conjecture, the North Koreans have never displayed a missile in a parade, whether you want to call it a mock-up or not, that wasn't either deployed or about to be deployed. They just haven't. So when you saw these reports in the press that this missile was a mock-up and might not be real, okay, certainly possible, but the North Koreans have never done that before. Nodong, Taepodong, Scuds, KN-1s, KN-2s, they put them in parades after they were ready to go. So something to keep in mind. And as an aftermath of this, and this is something I want to discuss because I think it's very important. The other Bruce might discuss this as well. As the aftermath of this, we saw a call in the ROK for, well, we now need extended range on our missiles, our own ballistic missiles. I've seen ranges of 800 kilometers or up to 1,000. Right now they're limited to 300. And that's interesting, and certainly if South Korea wants to do that, I'm sure our governments will work something out because we are allies. But let me point something out, okay? They can get as many of those missiles as they want in South Korea. They can extend the range as long as they want. It's not going to protect one person, one population center, one military base. If South Korea wants real defense against those Scuds and Nodongs that North Korea has facing them, they need to buy advanced PAC-3 BMD systems. They need to buy to protect their cities and to protect their bases, and they need to buy SM-3, not SM-2, SM-3 ballistic missile defense systems for their King Sejong class Aegis-equipped ships. They need to do that tomorrow, because right now, if North Korea was to fire Scuds at Seoul or Nodongs at Pusan or Jeju-do, the South Korean people might as well just open up their suit jackets and do this, because they have no defense against those missiles right now, except the BMD from the PAC-3s that protects U.S. bases on South Korea. So I ask that you think about that. The other concern that we've seen that is happening on the Korean Peninsula since Kim Jong-il died is cyber warfare and electronic warfare. We saw cyber warfare attacks just in the past couple of weeks. And for those of you who read the paper, which I think is just about everybody in here, you know that the guys with the tape on their glasses, you know, they've been, nothing against you, Dave. They have been they've been using computer network attack against the Blue House, against lots of government agencies in South Korea, South Korean corporations, and South Korean television and press outlets, as everybody knows. Even more significant, or at least it drew even more attention, was the navigation systems attack that the North Koreans conducted against at least 700 aircraft between April and early May of this year. South Korean aircraft, American aircraft, Russian aircraft, Chinese aircraft, and that was very recently, and they have electronic warfare gear that can jam GPS systems on civilian aircraft. Not only do they have these systems, they proliferated them to other nation states in the Middle East, which is nice. And they were blocking the GPS systems of maritime craft in the West Sea. And getting back to Professor Hong's talk, when you're jamming systems of ships that are right along a border area, they tend to cross the border area and get caught up in wars and stuff and combat, it's not a good thing. So another concern, South Korea needs to address this by beefing up the number of personnel and electronic warfare units and by significantly beefing up their resources and personnel in their anti-cyber warfare units. Sir, 3 minutes? I've got 3 minutes to say my last three things. And finally, as all of this relates to provocations, let me say this, my own personal opinion about provocations. The ROK U.S. Alliance has done an outstanding job of deterring war in the peninsula since 1953. They have not done as good a job deterring provocations. And those provocations have four things in common. One, they are intentionally initiated during moments in history, and they will have the likelihood of garnishing the most attention on the regional and perhaps even the world stage. Two, they appear to be incidents that are small, easily contained, and quickly resolved. Three, the most important one, they always involve changing tactics, techniques, and procedures, or TTP. That's what makes them so difficult to deter. And four, North Korea denies responsibility for the event. Even Yon Pyeongdo, we're watching CNN and smoke's coming out of the town, and the Koreans are going, North Koreans are going, you know, they started it. You know, bad juju. Deterring these provocations will be one of the biggest challenges the alliance faces as it moves forward, and many steps have been taken, especially since 2010. But please allow me to remind everyone, because this is very important, no matter what steps the democracy of South Korea and its key ally, the United States, takes to deter provocations, they're still going to happen. Probably we'll see some this year. All that I would ask everybody to think about is when a provocation does happen, that everybody doesn't spaz out. We can't fight. Oh my gosh, what do we... Handle the provocation. Have good rules of engagement. Be ready for it. Deter them. But it's not... But panicking and having terror in the South is exactly what the North Koreans want when they create these provocations. So I just ask everybody that they think about that. And I'm done, sir. Minutes?
18 and a half, you did good.
Thank you very much. I'm Bruce Klingner, and my wife's name is Deanne, which is translated as she who lets me think I run the household, but who actually knows better. The first two panelists discussed the very broad spectrum of security threats from North Korea. The nuclear weapons, the missiles, the special forces, cyber attacks, and conventional forces. And as the Chonan and the Yongpyongdo attacks clearly showed, that these are not merely hypothetical threats, but they are indeed very real dangers. And we've also heard about how even North Korea's weaknesses pose a challenge to the alliance. A failed leadership transition, and the jury really is still out on Kim Jong-un's leadership transition and whether he can retain power. But a failed transition, a regime collapse, could in turn trigger sort of all the perhaps worst case, low probability but high impact scenarios of instability, massive refugee flows, humanitarian disaster, Chinese incursion into North Korea, loss of control of nuclear weapons, and perhaps civil war. So, but instead what I'm going to focus on is the necessary steps that the alliance must take in order to better defend against all of those threats. Now, neither South Korea nor the U.S. military has been stagnant in responding to these threats, particularly the two acts of war in 2010. So in assessing how well the alliance is doing, I think we first have to think of all the moving parts that the alliance is currently undergoing. The alliance has already been transforming into a strategic alliance, a global alliance. They've been responding to the growing North Korean nuclear and missile capabilities. They're enhancing conventional deterrence and defense capabilities in response to the 2010 attacks. They're realigning U.S. forces in Korea, and all while preparing for OPCON transfer. And if that weren't enough, they're doing it while the U.S. is slashing its defense budget, yet still claiming a pivot to Asia, implementing a new air-sea battle strategy, and realigning the U.S. Marine Corps in the Pacific. So really, that's the equivalent of trying to change the tires and work on the engine on a race car while it's still going around the track at about 200 miles an hour. Now, I tend to be sort of a glass half empty kind of guy. I take positive developments for granted and focus instead on the areas that still need improvement. And that tends to drive my kids crazy when they bring home report cards, which, you know, may be very, very good, but not perfect. But I think in this case, we really have to acknowledge all that's already been accomplished by the alliance in the transformation. So not only progress on the things I've already mentioned, but the alliance has already completed Op Plan 5029. That's the contingencies other than a full-scale invasion by the North. They've completed earlier this year a joint plan of response to North Korean provocations. They created the Northwest Islands Command, and they've done extensive work on Defense Reform Plan 307, which has been created, though not yet approved by the National Assembly. Now, of all these initiatives, I want to focus primarily on the South Korean defense reform, perhaps because it's the one that's gotten the least attention. So a little bit of a background. The initial defense reform plan under the Nomu-hun administration was called the DRP, Defense Reform Plan 2020, because it was supposed to be completed by the year 2020. And that was to transform the South Korean military into a smaller yet more capable force. And the ROC military manpower is going to be reduced by 25% from 681,000 down to about 500,000. And for example, the Army was going to disband four corps and 23 divisions. And it was driven largely by demographic conditions. Another analyst, Bruce Bennett of RAND Corporation, has done extensive work on this and pointed out how South Korea is going to have fewer and fewer draft age males. Right now there's about 400,000 per year, but that would go down to about 250,000 individuals available by the year 2020. And that manpower shortage would also be compounded by President Ngo's decision to reduce the conscription period from 26 months down to 18 months. Now, even though demographics was really driving the boat on it, it was also influenced by President Ngo's ideology. His desire to create a less militarized South Korean society, also for political factors, appealing to the youth vote by reducing conscript levels and also the length of military service, and also his attempt to improve relations with North Korea by reducing the South Korean threat to the North. And he assumed that the North would reciprocate by also reducing their military, though that's not how things turned out. And he also wanted to operate or have South Korea operate with a greater independence from the United States, as Heath declared it, sort of restoring South Korean sovereignty. Now, the plan was that South Korea would compensate for these decreased troop levels by procuring advanced fighter and surveillance aircraft, naval platforms, and improved ground combat vehicles. Yet really, from the very beginning of the plan, the government failed to devote sufficient funding to develop those systems which would compensate. So really, right from the starting gate, it resulted in decreasing South Korean military capability. Now, when Lee Myung-bak came into office, he saw the shortages, and in 2009 did some tweaks to DRP 2020, but really the far more extensive revisions was called DR 307, and that was in March of last year. The Lee Myung-bak administration announced 73 short, medium, and long-term military reform objectives to be implemented during the years 2011 to 2030. So the plan is called 307 because it was announced on March 7th, and when it's actually implemented or approved by the National Assembly, it's either going to be called 1130 because it's take place from 2011 out to 2030, or also called DR 2030. I'll just keep calling it 307 for simplicity's sake. Now, it really was not either a total replacement for the Ngo administration plan, nor was it really triggered solely by the 2010 attacks, as many people have depicted it. It really was sort of layered on top of DRP 2020, and also because the Lee Myung-bak administration had already realized a number of things had to be changed. You know, now that said, the 2010 attacks on Cheonan and Yeongpyeongdo, you know, certainly did spark a shift in South Korean defense planning, and Seoul interpreted the attack on the Cheonan as an indication that Pyongyang's asymmetric warfare capabilities were increasing, and the artillery shelling of Yeongpyeongdo underscored that North Korea's conventional forces could not be ignored. And that was a point that I know Bruce Bechtel has written in countless articles, sort of the lone voice in the wilderness, trying to remind people that we can't just focus on nuclear and missile forces, that we do have to focus on conventional forces. And that was unfortunately made all too clear by the two attacks. And also the deficiencies in South Korea's military response to the attacks really demonstrated the need to expand and accelerate ongoing efforts to improve South Korean joint operational capabilities. So South Korea really shifted the main focus, the main priority of its defense planning from preparing for a large-scale invasion and total war to also include more flexible, customized responses to localized military attacks such as in the West Sea. And so there's also a greater focus on near-term initiatives rather than long-term initiatives such as developing a blue water navy. Now, I'll leave it to the paper I provided to go into more of the details on 307, but just to point out a few things. I think it's a very positive development. I think it lays a strong foundation for South Korea's assumption of wartime OPCON. And I think Seoul should be commended for creating an organizational structure that's capable of assuming independent operational military command. And it also improves Seoul's ability to conduct large-scale military ops in response to a North Korean invasion, while also creating a more flexible and joint South Korean military for responding to provocations. Now, to mention just two of the initiatives in the plan, it improves the military service jointness, interoperability, and combat effectiveness by restructuring the top military command structure and better integrating the different military services. For example, the Joint Chiefs of Staff is strengthened, so the chairman will now command all operations during peacetime as well as war after OPCON transfer, and the chairman will operate as a theater operational commander. And then the service chiefs will be put under him in a operational chain of command, and really I think it transforms the Joint Chiefs of Staff into a inter-service operational command. And then the other initiative that I had mentioned was this developing the Northwest Islands Defense Command to improve capabilities against North Korean incursions in the West Sea. Now, of course, there's still areas for improvement. And South Korea's military deficiencies really are a result of insufficient interconnectivity between the services and also C4ISR and training to conduct cross-service ops. So right now, if you look at the structure, Combined Forces Command, which will, of course, disappear after OPCON transfer, it really currently provides the cross-integration and jointness for South Korean forces at subordinate levels because they all tie into CFC. And so that really, CFC now is providing an overall coordinating body for South Korea's military. So that would have to be substituted for after CFC disappears. So South Korea really needs to put into place a much more agile command and control structure to enable joint military power at the tactical level with the control at the operational or even the strategic level. So what does South Korea need to do? Well, there are a number of things. One is fully fund their defense requirements. That's been a long-term problem for a number of years. They also need to adopt more of a whole package concept when procuring new combat systems by also including funding for sort of the more mundane aspects of maintenance, supply, training, and munitions. There's been a number of logistical shortfalls because the funding is set aside for buying the shiny new bauble, but then not providing enough funding to actually man it and staff it and train it and put in enough bullets. Another aspect is to emphasize joint combined interoperability when making acquisition decisions and when conducting training. And what that means is more flexible systems to fulfill multiple missions and enhance interoperability. And a key aspect, and one that folks from U.S. Forces Korea will emphasize over and over, is C4ISR. They see that as a critical capability that's necessary to enable integrated combat capabilities and command and control down to the tactical level while the South Korean units are on the move. Also, there needs to be acquisition of long-range precision strike capabilities, fifth-generation fighters, attack helos, extended-range surface-to-surface missiles, and counter-battery radar and artillery systems. Also, increase sea lift and airlift for the South Korean Marine Corps by purchasing more amphibious ships, transport helicopters, and that's something, again, I know that Bruce Bechtel has long been advocating. Also, implement a plan or a recommendation by a presidential task force, which is to expand the South Korean Marine Corps by about 4,000. The earlier plan had been to cut it by a similar amount. But it does look like they've taken that into account and will increase the force. And expanding the ROC Marine Corps actually serves a number of purposes. It enhances any defense of the Northwest Islands, but it also increases their full spectrum battle capabilities or attack capabilities against the North. And it also supports South Korea's or Im Young-bak's global Korea strategy because it would permit South Korea to have greater off-peninsula participation in UN peacekeeping operations. Also, as Bruce has mentioned, South Korea needs to purchase PAC-3 and SM-3 missiles, but also then has to be integrated into an interoperable with a comprehensive allied missile defense system. President Noh Myuhan and Kim Dae-jung were very strongly against that. Im Young-bak has said the right things and said South Korea is interested in that, but so far the actions have not matched the rhetoric. Now, admittedly, that's a very one-sided list of recommendations. So in return, what should the U.S. provide to South Korea? The first thing, and as this administration and previous administrations have done, but there can never be enough of, is repeatedly affirm U.S. support for South Korea's defense. The message should be, we have your back, whatever it takes. And there really can be no doubt of U.S. resolve in the minds of Seoul, of Pyongyang, and Beijing. And we should also allow South Korea to extend its ballistic missile range beyond the current limit of 300 clicks and out to a range allowing them to be able to target any North Korean military target from wherever they need to in the south, say about 800 or 1,000 clicks. Now, I think that should be done, that should be tied with, in conjunction with South Korea, buying into a more comprehensive ballistic missile defense program. And in talking with both U.S. and South Korean officials, it seems like there is movement on that, or at least on the extending the missile range. Right now, State Department is sort of advocating being only partly pregnant by moving from 300, but rather than the military requirement of 800 to 1,000 clicks, of just sort of splitting the difference and allowing South Korea to do it to 550. That really makes no sense. If we decide to go beyond the current range, we should do what is militarily required. The U.S. also has to maintain a robust forward-deployed military presence in the Western Pacific. And that means fully implementing the ongoing U.S. military realignment plans in both South Korea and Japan. The current Senate Armed Service Committee plan does not do that and would undermine very difficult and long-standing diplomatic agreements. We also need to maintain a strong U.S. Marine Corps presence in the Western Pacific. The newly announced realignment plan is better than the 2006 plan because it keeps MAGTAF's Marine Air Ground Task Force units together. But the problem is it moves some of the Marines further away from potential conflict zones or further away from potential humanitarian disaster areas. And the problem is it doesn't address already insufficient military transport requirements. The Marines said they needed 38 amphib ships. U.S. Navy said, we'll give you 33. And the current defense budget has plans for 30 or even less, and that's even before sequestration. So insufficient air and sea lift is a critical shortfall, not only for the Marine Corps, but for overall U.S. forces. And also, the U.S. needs to fully fund its defense requirements. We can't do that by cutting $486 billion, as well as an additional $500 billion, which will happen automatically if the Congress and the executive branch can't get together on sequestration, which is a Damocles sword hanging over the Pentagon's head right now. And as for the Asia pivot, it's a very good strategy. There should be an increased emphasis on Asia, but right now there's a lot less than meets the eye. The rhetoric is strong, but there's a great disconnect between the rhetoric and the actions. So in conclusion, as it moves forward on these defense reform plans, South Korea, we have to remember, doesn't bear its security burdens alone, and that the alliance with the U.S. will continue to play an irreplaceable role in not only maintaining peace and stability, but defending a key ally of the United States. And despite these security reform initiatives, South Korea will remain heavily reliant on U.S. military capabilities. And Washington should therefore support Seoul's defense reform initiatives while continuing to ensure its security through our own military deployments and extended deterrence. So overall, though I tend to be a pessimist, I think right now, looking at the alliance, I think the view ahead is a very good one. Thank you very much.
Okay, so now we have a 10-minute coffee break. Hey, everybody was on the excellent job. I will We started 4 minutes late, but you guys made up some confusion of his slides.
I'm not sure if you're going to be able to do it.